You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varasgetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Well, hello there. How's your Wednesday? Great to have you along for this hour. And before the news at 1 o'clock today, I want to pick up on a point that was mentioned earlier in the week. I hope you heard this conversation with agronomist Simon Teakle, and talking about the dry seasonal conditions pretty much sums up conditions right across the grain growing areas of Western Australia. But he did make a point about social media and how maybe too much of it can be, you know, not great for you, especially. And he's got some clients like this who are constantly looking at social media, and you can see what's going on at, say, a farm in your community or a farm in another region, say, hundreds of kilometres away from you. You can see the crop popping up and you're thinking, why isn't that happening at my place? And how that can affect you. And you shouldn't be looking at things like that, because really it makes no difference to what's going on your particular property. Today we'll pick up on that point, talk to a farmer about that and how you kind of got to pull yourself back off it and put the phone away for a little bit, get yourself off for a little while. And also Owen Catto talking about the effects of social media on you too. That's after 12:30 today. And do you remember the name Neil Garnett? Now, at one stage, he was Australia's most successful merino sheep breeder. He set an industry record for a ram, and that record stood for 30 years. Well, just before we check in on the Katanning sheep prices today, before the news at one, you're going to hear from Neil Garnett. And it's the first time he's done an interview since the collapse of the stud he once owned, which is the historic South Australian-based Collinsville stud. He's still into sheep, but what might surprise you is despite record wool prices, Neil Garnett is now breeding sheep meat. That's after 12:30 today. And all the talk in rural circles today is about the McCarthy Review into the live sheep trade during the northern summer months. It was due to be released today, but then there was this last-minute change of plans. But what I can tell you today, and you would have heard it in the 12 o'clock news, ahead of the review's release tomorrow, is the plan at this stage, is that there's going to be no ban on Australian live sheep exports to the Middle East over the northern summer period. Now, that's what the ABC has been told ahead of the official release. ABC rural reporter in Canberra is Brett Worthington. Brett, no suspension of the trade in this review. That's what the ABC has been told. Any other details coming through at this point?
Well, that's very much in line with what the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, has been saying for some time now. What this report has largely been going to be focused on is the stocking density, so the number of sheep you can have in pens. Because essentially the report could have said you can have one sheep per pen and send them off to the Middle East and it's safe to do so. That's not what it's going to recommend. It's going to be recommending a reduced number of sheep in the pens. And what that number will be, or the formula that is going to be used to determine that, is where the really interesting point in this is. You've got animal welfare groups that want it phased out together, and they say that in the interim it needs to be halved, the stocking density. Industry, though, is saying that that's absolutely unviable in terms of maintaining the industry and making money. So that's where the debate will lie tomorrow, in what that recommended reduction will be. And then some of the other things you probably see is an independent observer being on these ships, having to send back daily reports to officials in Canberra to ensure that the welfare of animals is being maintained and they're travelling in conditions that's appropriate.
Now, what response do you think that's likely to get from really both sides of this debate, the industry and the animal welfare groups, the fact that the suspension isn't there?
The government's going to have no friends tomorrow, you'd think, because it's likely that it's going to be a strong recommendation in terms of a reduction. You could even see anywhere up to 25% reduction in the stocking density. Animal welfare groups will say, well, that's not far enough, and anything short of a complete plan to phase it out altogether is a failure. Industry, though, will be saying that's far too draconian, that it's unviable at those points, and that will ultimately, they'll use West Australian farmers as their example of who the ones will be losing out from this. The reality is, though, industry will have to accept largely what government puts forward, because the other alternative is that they don't get to do it at all. So it'll be annoying, but I think they'll just have to accept it. And animal welfare groups, I guess, will also have to live with it if this is what the government of the day decides it's going to implement.
Brett, can we backtrack a little? Because the big anticipation was that this McCarthy review was going to be released 7 o'clock Canberra time this morning. What happened?
Well, it went to Cabinet last night that it's absolutely been confirmed. And now the rest of what actually happened and what went down is depending on where you sit on the debate. This story really goes to the heart of some of the tensions that lie within not just the coalition, but even within the heart of the National Party and the future of that party in terms of future aspirants and who might want to lead it in future years. My understanding is that that David Littleproud was keen on there being some level of delay, only because they felt that it hadn't, not all the ducks were lined up and in place. My understanding now is that whatever happened from when Cabinet met last night to this morning, when I received confirmation that it's going to be released tomorrow, they feel they're in a position now where everything is where they want it to be, that they are ready to release the report and then also announce their recommendations as well. And that is expected to happen around 9 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow morning.
11 past 12, ABC WA. This is The Country Hour. I'm Belinda Varaschetti and you're listening to Brett Worthington. He's the ABC's rural reporter based out of Canberra and talking about the latest developments in this McCarthy review into the live sheep trade into the northern summer months. It is now due out tomorrow, as Brett just telling you. But what we have had confirmed today is that there will be no suspension of that sheep trade to the Middle East in that northern summer period. What response from the federal opposition, Brett?
Joel Fitzgibbon says that he wants this report to say it needs to be phased out and the trade has no future. He also has been critical of the government and saying that they should have released it by now, that this is now in his mind long overdue and we're getting ever closer to the Northern Hemisphere summer, which is that dangerous period. This is the period in which you see these mass fatalities because of heat stress when going to the Middle East. And he says that now you needed to have the protocols in place to deal with that, and any delay is throws more uncertainty into the future.
Now, over on this side of the country, Brett, the State Agriculture Minister, Alana McTiernan, saying that this delay just causes further uncertainty for farmers. What effect do you think the delay is having?
I think what some people forget, particularly over on this side of the country, is that it's not, you don't just turn this thing on and say, okay, we're going to send 50,000 sheep to the Middle East tomorrow. That farmers have forward contracts, everyone's planning to work out where things are at. You're entering a busy period and it's unclear what the conditions will be. So farmers are starting to feel that uncertainty of not knowing what is going to happen next. At the same time, regulators don't know what conditions they'll be imposing, because no matter what happens and no matter where the debate goes, regulators regulate based on the law of the land. And so if the government wants to change those rules and wants the regulate to do it in a different manner, then they need to change the rules. And that's what needs to happen in this place so that then everyone knows what's going to happen.
The ABC has a copy of a letter written by Graham Dawes, the managing director of the livestock export company Emmanuel's. It's written to, as it says on the letter, valued producers and stakeholders. What are the key points in that letter?
He's saying that he's had nothing but support from the live stock industry and members of the community. He has had a whack at Alana McTiernan and David Littleproud, and I quote, "Many such criticisms are poorly informed and need to be put into context." And then he outlines 12 points of what he says is correcting the record. I think the interesting thing to take out from this is that Graham Dawes is absolutely correct when he says these matters were investigated at the time by the regulators. Where the story has changed, though, since then, is that since viewing the footage, both Alana McTiernan and David Littleproud have said if what they saw was not a breach of the laws, then it needs to be, and laws need to be changed to reflect that. And that's where they're going so far as now, is to say that directors could be held personally responsible if you see incidents like this happen in the future. So Graham Dawes is absolutely correct when he's saying the regulators investigate it, but the ministers in charge say that they need to go further in the future.
And just to wrap up for us, Brett, that McCarthy review due out 9 o'clock Canberra time tomorrow.
As we sit here today, yes, but you know, this thing is changing constantly. So I'm not a betting man anymore after learning how this deals with, but we do expect that that is likely to happen.
All right, that's the latest anyway. Thank you so much for that, Brett.
Thanks, Mel.
Brett Worthington, ABC rural reporter based out of Canberra. Yes, at this point, we think 9 o'clock tomorrow for that McCarthy review into the sheep trade to the Middle East over the Northern Hemisphere summer. 14 past 12.
Have your say on The Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
News headlines. Not too far away at 12:30, then checking in with the weather conditions for you with a cross to the bomb. First, though, citrus canker disease has now been confirmed on six properties in the Northern Territory. A citrus fruit and plant material has been banned from leaving the Northern Territory, and a national response plan is now in place. Taking you back a little bit to 2004, the disease wiped out millions of dollars worth of crops around Emerald. This is in Queensland. Matt Brand spoke to the NT's Chief Plant Health Officer, Sarah Corcoran, who says the outbreak is still classed as a very low-level infection.
It's not widespread at this stage, and we are gathering information every day that is giving us a bigger picture about what we're dealing with. We currently have 6 infected premises, so that means that they're properties that we have confirmed citrus canker from. But we have been out doing quite a bit of surveillance in our production areas, in nurseries, and also within residential properties. And in some of our production areas, like we've visited today, I think we're visiting our 15th orchard, and those properties have contained over 20,000 trees. So we're looking far and wide, and we're still dealing with a very low-level infection at this stage.
So of the 6 properties, are any of them commercial businesses?
One of those is a production nursery, and the other 2 are retail outlets, and we have been following up with each of those businesses about what surveillance and what tracing information we can prioritise from their sales info. And we've also been appealing to members of the public, to the community, that if they've got sick plants, they should report them to us and we'll come and take a look. And the other 3 IPs that have been confirmed have actually come to us through that process. So we're really appreciative of the public support that we've received.
So they're backyard people that have come to you with problems.
That's correct, yeah. Yes.
Now, the National Management Group, it met on Friday to talk about a response plan. Can you tell us what was decided?
Sure. The response plan that we've built is a 6-month plan, and it will provide us with a direction on how we go forward with this citrus canker incursion. Essentially, the plan lays out for us the delimitation of the disease, so we need to know where it is, and from that, we will be eradicating it where we find it. So those properties that I've mentioned that we have confirmed the disease from, we have gone through a destruction process of those infected plants and any other host that may also express or be a host to citrus canker.
So, for example, that commercial nursery would have had all of its citrus plants removed and destroyed?
That's correct. Yep, all of the citrus were removed and destroyed, as well as other potential hosts for citrus canker.
Yeah, and I'll bring Dr. Kim Rittman into this. For you, at a national level, what's the risk that this outbreak, albeit a small one in the Territory, will cause trade issues for the wider Australian citrus industry?
So, thanks, Matt. Yeah, so obviously Australia's got to maintain its good, clean, green image and favourable pest and disease status. We're not aware of any trade implications at this time. The department has contacted key trading partners, advised them of the initial detection, and also explained the emergency biosecurity measures that have been activated. It's important that we have this national response plan because what we need to do is get rid of this pest and contain it to as limited area as possible.
So it's been found on 6 properties. How quickly can it spread? How big's the threat for anyone that's got a citrus plant in the backyard or on the farm?
So first of all, if you've got something that's looking sick and shows the symptoms, report it, because it is a highly contagious disease. It's wind-blown and especially likes moist, windy conditions. It can be mechanically spread. It's very important that if you've got a sick plant to be able to report it.
Dr. Kim Rittman, Australia's Chief Plant Protection Officer, ABC WA, 12:19.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Taking you now to Western Australia's Great Southern region, where Deb and Rob Sutton have just harvested their first commercial crop of pomegranates. Now, WA's pomegranate industry is pretty small, and in the supermarkets, you'll normally see them from California in November and December. But the fruit's juice has high levels of antioxidants, and it was those health benefits that first got Deb and Rob excited about the fruit.
It's early morning on WA's south coast, and two pomegranate producers are headed to the orchard to pick the last fruits of this year's harvest.
Yes, they have. Yep, he can go.
Then the pruning starts, and there's another two beauties here.
Yep.
Deb Walker and her partner Rob Sutton first discovered pomegranates when Deb was diagnosed with an aggressive form of breast cancer.
I had a diagnosis in Christmas Eve 2013 of breast cancer as part of my recovery because, you know, chemotherapy and radiation all take its toll on your body. My niece came to visit and she brought with her a pomegranate and she said, you need to look into these and put these on your diet.
After a year and a half of chemotherapy, Deb decided to include pomegranates in her diet to help rejuvenate her health.
I mean, look at the insides of these ones.
That's when Rob found there were few local growers taking advantage of Southern WA's ideal conditions for producing pomegranates.
I went to the supermarket after Christmas, and because I'm very a staunch local product person, and saw that the pomegranates we were purchasing were American. I thought, well, this has got to be an opportunity. So I researched it, put some testers in, they responded well, and that's got us to here today. The older ones are 3 years in the ground, and they've actually fruited a little bit earlier than industry expectation, and that was probably because we prepared the ground very, very well using a lot of composted pig manure and had it ripped a metre deep and then covered back with well-composted wood chips and then reticulated and then just about sing to them and talk to them every night. I call them my girls. Nearly 3,000 of them now.
They've just picked this year's harvest and say locally grown pomegranates have been met with a good response.
The market's been great. We've had great response at the local markets and the local independent supermarkets are backing us really, really well. But people are keen to find out what to do with them, how to use them, how do you get the seeds or the arils out, how do you juice them. So it's been great for us and the public.
We hoped to supply our local market. We would like to set up a farm gate sale here so that people could, when they come to visit the lovely Prongrups, could pop in, have a look at the orchard and help just really share with what we've discovered.
It's a vision they plan to realise together.
My prognosis has been good because I found it early, and also too, we're just so lucky to live in a country where we receive such good medical attention.
Deb and Rob Sutton from WA's Great Southern Region catching up there with the ABC's Aaron Fernandez and putting their story on the WA Country Hour Facebook page. A link to the story up shortly, should be around about 1:30, so later this afternoon when you've got some time on your hands, have a look through on the Facebook page. 12:23. A maritime treaty on Australia's northwestern border has helped kickstart a new oil project. Carnarvon Petroleum has raised $20 million for its redevelopment of the Buffalo oil field, and this follows a maritime treaty between Australia and Timor-Leste that put the project into Timor's waters. Carnarvon Managing Director Adrian Cook says oil production could start at the Buffalo field as soon as 2020.
The work we've done technically has given us a very high level of confidence about the project, which is why last week we raised some additional capital so that we can drill the Buffalo 10 well next year. It will be a confirmatory well that we'll keep as our first production well, and then we would be planning to move reasonably quickly, so some 18 months to 2 years after that well, to bring that field onto production.
A successful capital raising of up to $20 million has also given Carnarvon Petroleum the money it needs to go ahead with its Phoenix gas projects just offshore from Port Hedland. And Mr Cook says the gas project and the associated construction around that will bring jobs and economic benefit to the region. And the company would like to see gas production at Phoenix begin around 2022.
It's a tremendously exciting opportunity, and we are currently drilling our fifth and about to embark on our sixth well in this project. The previous four wells all made oil, gas and condensate discoveries. It's definitely in Australian waters. It's around 150 kilometres offshore of Port Hedland. What we're looking for in these next two wells this year is to cement the commerciality of this project, and in doing so, then really start to narrow in on how the project would be developed.
Carnarvon Managing Director Adrian Cook with the ABC's John Daly. 25 past 12 on the Country Hour. And on the Country Hour, if you're a regular, you know we talk about the weather quite a bit here during this hour between 12 and 1 on ABC WA. We'll do that again, crossing to the Weather Bureau for you very shortly, just after checking in with the news headlines. But yesterday, talking to you quite extensively about the weather, even more than usual, because there was this big report out. It was commissioned by the Bureau of Meteorology, and it was called Farmers' Use of Weather and Forecast Information in WA's Wheat Belt. So really teasing through and picking out the main points out of that. And if you did miss it or you just want to go over it again, make sure you just have another listen to the podcast from Tuesday the 15th of May, so yesterday's show, and just go to about the halfway point, because pretty much the second half of the show yesterday was dedicated to that. Unfortunately, not a lot of great news around the weather at the moment for those in the grains area and mixed farmers across Western Australia. It's been a particularly dry autumn, but there is just a flicker of hope that some rain could be on the way. One of the longer range forecasting models that's used by the Bureau of Meteorology suggests a change could possibly be on the way. Now, as we talked about yesterday, farmers don't have much confidence in long range forecasts. So the ABC's Andrew Collins asked the Bureau's senior climatologist, Glenn Cook, how much money would be needed to be spent to improve the accuracy of forecast beyond 7 days?
Well, that's a great question, and there's no, you know, how long's a piece of string is the answer. If a lot of investment went into weather forecast models, then potentially we could get another day out of, you know, of useful accuracy out of the models. But the question is, how much investment do you need to be able to improve that accuracy? Again, getting another bigger supercomputer could potentially aid that progress.
How much does a supercomputer cost?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What does a supercomputer look like?
I'm sure you can stroll down to your computer shop and buy one, but you're talking, you know, at least tens to hundreds of millions of dollars, I would have thought, for a supercomputer. So they're not, you know, it's not cheap. It's serious investment. If we spent more money, I think we would get a better product, but then it might be 5% better. And how do you
quantify the merit of that spend?
Value of you're getting a 5% more accurate forecast.
Can you see in any of the models in the future some decent rain?
Well, interestingly, we're talking about sort of 10 days out, because one of the models that I'm looking at is suggesting that we might see a bit of a change to the pattern later, well, towards the end of that 10-day period, so perhaps later next week. But as we spoke about, the accuracy of models out at that distance can be pretty questionable.
And so what's the accuracy percentage on that one, do you think?
Oh, look, yeah, probably 50-50. But the encouragement with it is that it's showing a change in the pattern. So the big high-pressure system is moving away from us, and so if that's any indication, then hopefully, fingers crossed, we're seeing some change to the pattern towards the end of this month and perhaps some rainfall to the southwest.
All right, so a little bit of hope there from Glenn Cook, the senior climatologist with the Bureau of Meteorology here in Western Australia. Just recapping the lead story today, talking to you about it just after the news at 12 o'clock, the McCarthy Review, this is into the live sheep trade during the northern summer months. It was due to be released today, but there was a last-minute change. Anyway, the latest is it's going to come out at 9 o'clock tomorrow. That's Canberra time, 9 o'clock tomorrow. But the ABC has learned today that there will be no ban or suspension on Australian live sheep exports to the Middle East over the northern summer this year. That's what the ABC has been told. So no ban within that McCarthy review, which is due out tomorrow. There is the details of that story on the WA Country Hour Facebook page, and that's where Reece has left a comment. He says, great news for the WA sheep industry. Hats off to David Littleproud, the Federal Agriculture Minister, for going to industry leaders first to fix the problem and not getting brainwashed by the minority, in brackets, Animals Australia and the like. Thank you for that, Reece. You can leave your comment there or text through 0448 922 604. It's 12:30 and Michaela Carr in the studio. I'm sure you're keeping across the developments on the live trade and that review due out tomorrow, Michaela.
Indeed, Belinda. As you've just said, the ban on live exports to the Middle East over this year's northern summer, we have had that confirmed that there won't be a ban. The review of the trade isn't expected to be released, the fine detail, until tomorrow, but the ABC can confirm that there will be no end to the summer trade. The former Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has been released from jail after 3 years. Malaysia's newly elected Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad says he'll eventually stand down to allow Mr Anwar to take charge. The Premier Mike McGowan has ruled out the possibility of education services being cut, despite the government's efforts to rein in spending, as announced in last week's state budget. And the AFL has lodged appeals against last night's tribunal decisions involving Carlton's Ed and Charlie Curnow. The brothers were fined rather than being suspended for touching umpires in separate incidents during the Blues win over Essendon last weekend. An appeal hearing is set down for tomorrow afternoon. Belinda, so a big day tomorrow.
Sure is. Thank you for that, Michaela. Michaela back with the full news bulletin for you at 1 o'clock today. ABC WA on the Country Hour, 28 to 1. Still to come, before the news at 1 today, we're off to Katanning and you'll get the results of the Katanning sheep market today. Also talking about social media, it's a point that was raised earlier in the week by agronomist Simon Teakle, and he was just saying, you know, looking too much at what's going on in someone else's backyard, on someone else's farm, isn't always great for you to be comparing yourself to what's going on, sometimes in regions hundreds of kilometres away, and sometimes best to put the phone to one side. So picking up on that with Owen Catto shortly here on the Country Hour. First, off to the Weather Bureau with the details this afternoon. It is Mark Paul. Mark, anything changed since we spoke to you 24 hours ago or spoke to the bomb 24 hours ago?
Yeah, good day, Belinda. No, unfortunately not. That high pressure system still maintains its location in the Bight, and it's going to persist throughout this week, the weekend, and into next week as well. So really the only weather throughout the state for the next 4 days is a little bit of shower activity about the coastal Eucla, and those falls are going to be very, very light in what they will be. And up in the north, there's persistent east to east-southeasterly winds are still going to be gusty for the next few days as well. So quite gusty conditions up through the northern half of the state for the next 4 days, although they should start to moderate by Sunday. The only outlook at the moment as we go into next week, during Thursday and maybe Friday, there's signs that we could see the high move east and a front come up towards the west coast, but that's a long way off. We're just going to have to wait and see how that works out and whether it does pan out at all. But that is the only hope that I can sort of see in the longer term.
All right, well, we'll just keep tabs on that as each day progresses. Any warnings today?
Yeah, we've got the marine warnings, which are still current for the northern half of the state. They run from the Northern Territory border all the way around through to Shark Bay. They'll persist today and tomorrow. We've also got a fire weather warning for the East Pilbara Coastal and the West Pilbara Coastal districts as well.
Thank you very much for the details. 27 to 1 ABC WA. Just having a quick look at the rainfall for the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and nothing over 1 mil, in fact, right across Western Australia. Hopefully, as we've been talking about today, maybe in about 10-ish days or so, that may change. So we'll keep you posted on those weather developments. News for you at 1 o'clock and checking in with the Katanning Sheep Market just before that news bulletin. Right now, though, taking you off to Carnarvon, where, well, it's also been pretty dry this year, making it less than ideal start to the vegetable growing season in this region. Warm, windy and dry conditions have seen yields drop significantly for growers at Chinnery, Chapman and Sunga, who have recently started picking golden zucchinis for the Perth markets. Hazel Sunga says not a drop of rain has fallen on her farm this year, which means the dust is worse than usual.
This is the third pick of the golden zucchini, and it's looking really great. But the last pick was we got a bit windy days for the last 2 or 3 days, so they got a little bit scratches. But they are looking good now.
And it's been a bit of a dry year, hasn't it?
It's been very dry, I don't know, maybe two, 3 years, and I think that's what is the problem we got. The flowers are dying off. Whatever we got, the plants are growing really, really good, but minimal fruits in them.
How much less this year do you think compared to a usual season with a good rain?
It's nothing. We haven't have a drop of rain. So every time we have a little bit of wind blowing, even a sea breeze, the dust just flying everywhere.
So is it the dust that's causing the flowers to drop?
I think so, yeah. It's bringing a lot of disease like red spiders and all those type of things.
Must be difficult for the bottom line if you're losing a lot of your yield.
It is. It is, because usually in one plant we can pick two to five fruits in one plant. Now maybe one fruit here and one fruit there on the next plant.
So a fifth of what you would usually have.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very saddening, but yeah, it is.
And what about prices? How are they going for you?
The prices is because so far with some of them are scratches, but the good ones, the prices are sort of getting there.
And you've got the golden courgettes as well as the standard ones. Where are your markets for the golden ones? Do they go to the same place?
They are all going to the same market in Perth. I think the zucchinis, the bigger ones are the better, because with the dust, the courgettes, they are getting dirty easily and cannot wash them off. So the zucchini is better.
And you've also got some other interesting fruits around as well. Laffa? I'm not too sure the pronunciation.
Yes, we have some laffas. Laffa and some winter melon, some bitter melon. These are all Asian vegetables and they love them, so yeah.
And where are those markets?
They are all going to Perth as well.
What made you start growing these interesting fruits?
Because they are different and they look beautiful and easy to pick. That's it. Very easy to pick.
Oh, that sealed the deal. The ease of picking for Hazel Sunga, a vegetable grower in Carnarvon, catching up with the ABC's Michelle Stanley. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti taking you through until the news at 1 o'clock. It's 22 to 1. How much time do you spend on social media? You know, with those punching those apps at Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. If you add up each minute you spend scrolling on your phone, you could be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be surprised. I wonder how much it is. Have a think about it. How much time do you think you spend? Let me know this afternoon. Because too much time spent on social media is apparently increasing anxiety and stress for some primary producers. And they're being warned to reduce their online interactions and instead focus on what is within their control. This is what agronomist Simon Teakle told you early in the week.
I don't like social media in a lot of respects because it gives a lot of, it's like a fear of missing out. Like, so as soon as they find that there's something else where they've had a bit of rain or they've got crop out of the ground, it's like, oh, we're getting nervous, you know, like we're behind them. And I always like to talk to the growers that I deal with about just making sure you focus on what you're doing and what you can do on your farm to get the best out of your farm. And I just think social media just gives growers so much more access to what's happening around the place, 100 k's away, 200 k's away, 1,000 kilometres away, that is in some respects, of complete irrelevance to them.
Simon Teakle with his concerns about social media and comparing what's happening on your farm with other farms in the region or in some cases hundreds of kilometres away. Well, regional men's health community educator Owen Catto has pretty similar concerns about social media. As he told Joe Prendergast, it causes a fear of missing out effect, the FOMO effect, and also makes people second guess their management decisions. And none of that is healthy or helpful.
I guess the implication it has, Joe, is that it creates that second-guessing attitude, or it puts a bit of uncertainty, especially around the seasonality factors, and we've only got to just attach a bit of uncertainty to see what that does to people's mindset, whether it be personal, business or whatever. So it's actually kind of removing sometimes of the people living not in the here and now and dealing with their own stuff now, because it makes the paddock bigger, for want of a better word. But social media really enables people to look over the fence from the different point of view of comparing one state to another, one end of the state to another, and not comparing apples with apples.
Would you say that social media can exacerbate anxiety?
Yeah, look, in the work we do and just chatting with people, both in our personal and our business life, it can. There's some good things about social media, but there's the removal of people staying in the present, in my opinion. Like, so your situation has to be of paramount, and it's only your situation. It can't be your neighbour's or someone else's position that's 1,000 miles away. So there is that increased anxiety around that definition.
Social media has become the predominant form of communication and connection, particularly when it comes to younger people. And from what you're saying there, it doesn't sound like a really healthy thing, but can it have its advantages as well?
Oh, look, I reckon it really can, in terms of if it's used. I'm a snail mail person, but if it's used in its traditional context, in my opinion, which is say from the social networking part of organising events, or used in from the personal or the business sense in terms of organising stuff around our life. But the comparison is kind of the enemy of happiness, if you like. So when we compare stuff, it's just not comparing atypically apples with apples, Joe, and that's the issue.
Would you say that farmers are having enough face-to-face, one-on-one or group conversations these days?
No, look, I don't reckon we are, and because there's less of us bums on seats, and whenever we get out to a face-to-face meeting or breakfast or dinner or lunch or that, and that social connectedness is happening, it's just really powerful stuff, and people cherish that ultimately. And we're probably more time poor than we've ever been in our life, and I reckon that's probably symptomatic of there's less of us out there. There's less of us in regional West Australia, but it'll never replace face to face, and we might have even hit a little junction, I reckon, in the road where whatever gig we go to, people just really appreciate, you know, the face to face social connectedness that can happen.
So what do you say to people who may come to you and say, look, Owen, I'm feeling this anxiety, what advice do you give?
Oh, look, the first thing we say is talk to people around you that are important in your decision making. So hopefully that's like direct family. Then it might be your business advisor and your accountant. But most importantly and firstly, that we think that source of primary care is the immediate people around you.
Do you ever tell people to consider the amount of social media that they're consuming as part of that advice?
We definitely ask what they're involved in, and it's usually the younger people than myself. So we've actually got to put some rationale into what social media we're consuming. How often is really important, because as we know with messaging, and people are on social media quite often, whether it's in a workplace or within a group of farmers, they're just on it all the time. You can't have that stuff in your ear 24/7.
Regional Men's Health Community Educator Owen Catto, 16 to 1. I wonder if you're thinking about how much time you do spend on those different sites like the Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat. Adding it up, what would it get to? Would it be an hour? Would it be more? Let me know this afternoon, 0448 922 604. And while you think about that, I want you to meet Grenner farmer Ben Royce. Now, he reckons he checks his social sites 2 or 3 times a day. That doesn't sound like much to me, but maybe I'm a little bit more obsessive. But he's also had to be disciplined, as it can be an easy distraction.
Oh, you check it 2 or 3 times here and there when you've got a bit of a quiet spell, lunchtime and smoko, and yeah, see what everyone's up to.
And what sorts of conversations do you usually see on there at this time of year?
At the moment, everyone's asking where the rain is, why is the air seater broken, and when's lunch coming, when's smoko.
What do you think, hearing those conversations, particularly the more negative ones about the rain, the dust, the dry, what do you think that does, or what sort of effect does that have?
Oh, it's hard on social media because you don't want to say too much because no one really knows what's going to happen. But it is a worry because it is very negative, you know, at this time of the year, especially when it hasn't rained yet and everyone is waiting. You don't want to say too much in case, you know, it's taken the wrong way, or which it can be on social media quite easily.
Do you think we need to have more positivity on Facebook in general?
Yeah, it'd be good, yeah. I'm not sure how to do that. It's really to do this time of the season. I think when it's green, everyone seems to be a lot happier on Facebook.
On the flip side of that, though, it's almost a more supportive community because you can look at your phone anywhere in the paddock and look on various social media platforms and know that bit of anxiety that you're feeling, or that even just being sick of everything being dusty, that you're not alone in that.
Yeah, in that respect, it is good. You can feel like you're alone when you're not talking to people, but then you look on there and there's other people in the same situation. They're out in the paddock and they're waiting, or they're bogged, or they're, you know, frustrated, and you think, oh, it's not just me, it is, you know, the rest of WA or the Midwest, yeah.
Are you ever tempted to just go off it?
Yeah, not having signal is a good thing sometimes, actually. We're all talking about trying to get signal, but it's nice to be in the back paddock and not actually have signal.
Grenner farmer Ben Royce with the ABC's Joe Prendergast, 13 to 1.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
And very shortly, news for you at 1. And before the news, checking in with the prices at today's Katanning Sheep Market. Tracy Kilner along with those details for you shortly. First up, though, a new breed of sheep has been developed here in Western Australia. The Lamb Master is a composite of 8 different meat sheep breeds, and it's been bred at Margaret River, especially for our harsh Australian conditions. And while the location is a surprise, so is the man behind the 25-year-long breeding program. His name is Neil Garnett, and he was once Australia's most successful merino breeder, setting an industry record of $450,000 for a ram that has stood for 30 years. Landline's Sean Murphy caught up with Neil Garnett at a recent field day for the Lamb Master.
So from the time you were a boy on the knee of your grandfather, your every fibre was about the wool industry?
Yeah.
Now you're breeding meat sheep. Why the complete turnaround?
Well, you know, I don't believe there's anyone more passionate than me about the wool industry. I bet on the farm, on the wool industry, so to speak, or the success of the Wool Corporation. And we all know what happened to that, and I was one of their casualties. It's just one of these things you take on the chin and you get on with it. After owning Collinsville and setting, 10 or so, I think 8 or 10 world record prizes, and having the wonderful honour and pleasure of being part of that extraordinary time frame in the wool industry and meeting so many wonderful people throughout the world in sheep breeding, I just couldn't start breeding sheep, merino sheep, because I sort of felt as I'd climbed Mount Everest in the wool industry and that I really wanted to do something completely different. And certainly these sheep couldn't be more different because their skin is like a cow. It's completely no wool, no shearing, but it has a lot of the common traits and common principles in developing this new breed.
Neil Garnett hasn't spoken publicly about the collapse of South Australia's historic Collinsville Stud in 1990. He was a casualty of the biggest crisis in the history of Australia's wool industry, when the federal government withdrew its guarantee on the floor price. At the time, it was reported he'd walked away from Collinsville with debts totalling $43 million. With interest, it had blown out to more than $70 million.
Well, my actual debt was $23 million. When you get into a situation where blame is required, the Wool Corporation was in the mode of collapsing. We were banking with the State Bank. It's the only bank in the history of Australia to collapse. It was chaotic. It was very, very troubled times. We had just been through the interest rates of 19%. I'm not sure how people would cope these days with those sort of hits. So whilst I'm not trying to blame other people, and of course there are policy decisions you make, especially when the government guaranteed the floor price for wool and that it would never change. So my whole business plan was based on the success of the Wool Corporation, which was held up globally as one of the wonderful examples of success at that particular time. And to see that crumble and collapse meant there was nothing left in that regard. So I didn't lose other people's money. I was the only shareholder in Collinsville. There was no one else. It was just me.
Looking back on it now, how much of the blame would you accept personally?
Oh, look, I had to take most of the blame because it's Murphy's Law. This is what happens. If I was 5 years earlier or 5 years later, it's a timing issue. It could have been a completely different story. My slight pitch would be that I was a West Australian. At the time, we had the Alan Bond, the Christopher Skates, the high flyers, the entrepreneurs that became unpopular. I was always painted as a West Australian entrepreneur. And, of course, my wife and Ariane and I weren't far from that. I mean, Ariane was only 24 when we moved to Collinsville with a little family. We just simply got to work using technology and using everything I'd ever learned to introduce change into the wool industry. I had been working with the University of Western Australia on the development of the technology, which is now part of breeding and part of society generally, which was the freezing of ram semen, which had never occurred, laparoscopic insemination, and the synchronization of ewes' oestrus, which meant that you could artificially inseminate 1,000 ewes on one day from one ram. Now, this just changed the whole dynamics of sheep breeding. You could collect the semen from a ram when he was a young ram. You could progeny test him over 4 or so years. When he dies and you have the results, you could then multiply those genes 10,000 times. So this gave a new business model to the whole concept of stud breeding. That technology gave me the confidence to move forwards. And, you know, if the Wool Corporation hadn't have collapsed, we had gone from $2 million to $10 million income in a financial year at Collinsville. We had sold $1 million worth of semen from one ram, which really then made rams completely different in value. For example, to pay, which is the world record price now, of $450,000 for a ram, on the basis the owner could sell $1 million worth of semen, was a good investment. So they were different times, different environments, different costs and different pressures. But that is why I saw this opportunity and thought, well, you know, why die wondering? Let's do it and see how far we could go.
Neil Garnett has gone back to basics with the Lambmaster, which is a composite of 8 different meat sheep breeds, and it's being marketed for its easy care.
The Lambmaster's of sheep has evolved mainly from African genetics, utilising some of the more productive genetics from Israel and Europe. It is bred for harsh environments. It's a white animal. The basic principle is hardiness, good feet. Feet is a really big focus. Walking ability, family orientation, in other words, easy to manage. Quiet animals, animals that will thrive, animals that have self-reliance, that will look after themselves most of the time. In other words, minimum input from expensive Australian labour.
Neil Garnett, former owner of Collinsville Merino's stud, when it went broke with the wool price collapse, and now breeder of a new sheep called the Lamb Master. Speaking there to the ABC's Landline, Sean Murphy, and you can see the report on Lamb Master this Sunday on Landline at 12:30 or any time after that on iView. 5 to 1 on the country. A few comments on social media and whether you should be spending a lot of time there comparing your farm to what's going on in other regions. David in 2J says, often what you see on social media is a misrepresentation of people's circumstances anyway. You only see the best crop, the newest machine, and the best of people's lives. Don't let it faze you. And this from Paul in Nanup. I call my brother Mr. Facebook, as he's on it every day. I don't do any social media. I would rather watch paint dry. Thank you for that, Paul. 4 to 1 here on the Country Hour.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, the Inspector General of Taxation speaks to The World Today as he announces an investigation into the tax office over its controversial tactics to claw back debts.
Allegations such as these have a capacity to really affect people's confidence in the tax system, the fact that they are treated fairly and equitably. So it does have serious impact.
Also, the Australian research that may hold the key to dramatically reducing asthma in children. And could the federal government's plans to sell off a radio frequency network put the Weather Bureau's radar systems under a cloud?
More than the headlines, The World Today.
About 20,500 sheep yarded at Katanning last week. Tracy Kilner's at today's sale. Tracy, how did it go?
Hi, Belinda. Numbers were down for a total yarding of 19,406 sheep. The quality of all classes were mixed with a large number of store lambs on offer. Prices for prime lambs were up, but store lambs fell considerably. The heavyweight lambs in score 3 condition in the carcass weight range from 23 to 25 kilos made from $130 to $147 to return $5.58 to $6.10 carcass weight per kilo. Trade lambs in the 20 to 22 kilo range made from $125 to $142 to return estimates of $5.76 to $6.40 including skins. Score 1 and 2 lightweight weather lambs made from $41 to $117 depending on frame and quality, and the crossbred lambs went to feeders and processors at $65 to $107 with the extremely poor drafts from $5 to $55 a head. Mutton prices were strong with heavyweight ewes in the 24 to 30 kilo carcass weight range, selling from $90 to $126 including skins. That was $2 to $10 up on last week, returning $3.20 to $4.15 a kilo carcass weight. The lighter score 2 boning ewes, down to 15 kilos carcass weight, made from $35 to $77 a head. Good medium weight ewes in the 18 to 22 kilo range, made from $74 to $110, including skins, to remain equal to $3 up. The quality of the black tag ewes improved this week with values. The best drafts made from $85 to $125, and the light plain ewes sold for $35 to $70 a head. Limited number of weathers were available. Best lines made from $90 to $128 to processors, with some interest from live exporters. Most of the light and medium weight weathers were purchased by processors and some graziers at $47 to $72 a head. Mature rams sold to processors for $80 to $90 and up to $100 a head to live export. Store rams made from $10 to $50 a head. The best of the ram lambs sold to feeder buyers to $135 and live export for $80 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Tracy. Not far away from the news at 1. This through from Rob. Hi, Belinda. You always mention the wheat belt farmers waiting for rain for their crops. Don't forget all the livestock producers in the southwest who are also desperate for rain, for feed for their livestock. Let's hope everyone gets some much needed rain. I haven't forgotten, Rob, and we did mention, in fact, just yesterday, Milne Feed was talking on the program about how short feed is, the prices are going up, and how Milne Feed had to just restrict sales to pre-existing customers. But thank you for your text. You can text through any time. A reminder too, if you're driving in the southeast of the state today, Main Roads wants you to know the Brookton Highway between Ravensthorpe and Lake King is closed in both directions due to a truck rollover. There is a diversion in place. Good to talk to you. News time, 1 o'clock.